Okay. I do want to acknowledge some of my co-authors on this paper. Michelle Kipke is our principal investigator, and this is one part of a much larger study that we have been doing for the last 3 years with the Los Angeles House Involved Communities. So this is one of the first opportunities to present our findings. I have nothing to disclose to you. Okay, just really briefly, I think probably we all know that African-American young men who have sex with men are more likely to be infected with HIV compared to other groups, and also there's certainly a lack of prevention interventions available for them. In fact, there are no evidence-based interventions designed specifically for African-American young men. What's also interesting, and I think not necessarily addressed so much in the literature, is that this is a very homogenous population. Across the country, there's different pockets, but they also live and interact in different communities within single cities. And the House Involved Communities are one of those communities, and this is just one House Involved Community in Los Angeles. So House Involved Communities, what are they? They were derived from the Harlem drag balls in the 1920s, so they have a fairly long history. They currently exist in cities across the country. Any city that has a relatively large African-American population has a House Involved Community, usually very underground, and people are usually not aware of its presence. In fact, when I tell people that's what I do, no, most people in Los Angeles are unaware that it even exists. For those of you not familiar with the House Involved Community, if you've seen the movie Paris is Burning, came out in the late 80s, early 90s, a documentary of the New York scene, that's what it is. Madonna also kind of made it a little famous with her Vogue video. The dance moves come from the House Involved Community. And what they are is the houses involved are two separate but similar entities that work together. Houses are groups of individuals. I kind of compare them to fraternities in a way, where you have young men or women, transgender individuals who are a part of a house, and those houses are usually named after designers. The House of Escada, the House of Mizrahi, the House of Chanel. And then they compete in these balls, which are competitions around gender expression, dance, and athleticism, and they occur usually very late at night or early in the morning, depending upon how you think about it. Most of them in Los Angeles start around 3 in the morning and may end at 8 a.m., at which point they usually bring out some macaroni and cheese or something, which is great. And houses are identified as having a sense of family, friendship, and support. The houses have a mother and or a father that are the head of the house. They have brothers and sisters and princes and princesses, so there's a hierarchical structure within each house, and it differs from house to house. So in spite of the fact that I think these are such fascinating communities and just wonderful communities for the individuals that are a part of them in many ways, there's a lack of research around these communities. And in fact, there's really only one epidemiological study that came out about 2 or 3 years ago from the New York ball scene that showed an HIV prevalence rate of about 17%. So they are potentially very high-risk communities. And so this is one study that we undertook to better understand what those risks were and to think about how we could tailor prevention programs specifically for these communities. So our study methods, as I mentioned, this is one part of a much larger study. It was a community-engaged approach in that about 5 years ago, a couple of the house parents approached us. We were working on a different research study at the time, and were very concerned about their community, about the high risk of HIV, about the drug use and other issues going on in their community. So they came to us because we were around and asked us if we would be willing to work with them. So we have formed a partnership with them over the last few years. They hung out with us while we attempted several times to get funding. Anyone that's applied for NIH funding knows that can take years. But they stuck with us that whole time. And we have now a community advisory board of those house parents that we meet on a monthly basis, and we are presenting data to them, and they're making them kind of think about when interventions might actually work. They also helped us think about our study methods. So we administered a survey at house and ball events for a calendar year and got a total of 263 surveys. That picture in the corner is our survey booth that we developed that we put in the balls themselves. We did participant observations at Balls and their house meetings for several years as well, and semi-structured qualitative interviews with house leaders. We had at least one house leader from each of the 15 houses participate in that, and then focus groups with house members, and so we did 10 different focus groups with the different houses. Here's just a brief kind of snapshot of some of the demographics that we have. You see it's a relatively young population. 81% are 25 years or younger. Most of them are African American. That's different than some cities, especially New York. There's a relatively large Latino presence of Dominican and Puerto Rican members, and in Los Angeles, that's definitely not the case. In fact, most of the Latinos that are a part of this were from New York, had come in for Balls in Los Angeles. Most of them still live at home with their family, also relatively different from some other communities. And sexual identity, we had the majority, 71%, identifying as gay or some other same sex, 25% is bisexual, but 44% of the males said that they were attracted to both men and women. I did not put gender on this slide, but just so you know, about 10% were transgender, 85% were male, and the rest were biological female. So I'm going to focus most of this on qualitative analysis, and this is just kind of a picture, like, you know, it's a lot of words. So what we did is we did a constant comparative process of looking at our transcripts and defining the themes as they emerge. So some of the primary themes that pop out from this, the biggest, bigger words, the bigger font are the words that emerge the most from some of our transcripts. House, family, support, all those things were things that are identified as very supportive mechanisms. So I want to talk some about some of the supportive mechanisms because that's important to think about building interventions with. So one thing is that the basic structure of the houses, it connotates a sense of family and support. You have a mother, you have a father, you have your brothers and sisters. So it really is like a surrogate family in many ways. For some individuals, the house parents actually replace or supplement relationships with biological or gay families. Some individuals that might have been forced to leave their home, this is an option for them to have a more supportive family mechanism. It's also a subculture that provides a sanctuary where members can really freely express themselves. And this is something that came out in our interviews and our focus groups all the time, is that this is a place where actually young men can be validated for who they are, what maybe they've been shunned for who they are their whole lives. So this is a place where they're actually awarded trophies or money or other things for just being who they are. And so to me, that's just a wonderful, wonderful thing. And here's a quote, "For some reason, America is not ready for X-Men. Now, I use the term X-Men because we are people who are outcasted because of our sexuality. Sometimes we feel like X-Men and I'm Professor X rolling around in my wheelchair, and there's this great school for creative kids with the gift of being gay." So that family structure does provide house members support in the form of love, a place to stay, and some guidance. And here's another quote. "Some of us come from backgrounds where we were abused or kicked out or not really appreciated or supported by our own family because of our journeys, whatever they might be. So this is kind of an avenue to create that safe haven, really be able to say, I do belong to something. I am wanted." Another thing that's really interesting about the ballroom community is it recognizes all types of people. So they have categories for different body types, genders, talents, and if they recognize that there's maybe more females coming into the community, they'll create categories for the people that are coming into the community, so that's very inclusive. There's also a real sense, as I alluded to before, of acceptance and validation. So you're performing, you're awarded, and it recognizes performers who have made a name for themselves in the community. And there's a hierarchy within the ball scene themselves, of stars, statements, and legends, and everyone wants to become a legend, which means that you have been in the ball scene for at least 10 years. And this, again, is something that they may not have ever been able to get in the real world. It's like Cheers. It's like everybody knows your name. It's just a really cool outlet where you can be appreciated by people who understand who it is that you are or what it is that you do. And it's a place for, again, they're being celebrated, something they may have been ostracized for. I can be me. I'm in a place where I can fit in because they have different categories that I can fit into in a place that's actually going to award me. So here's another quote. That's not him, but it's a house father. "Well, my story is unlike any others due to the fact my ballroom scene started before I entered the ballroom. And what I mean by that in terms of wanting to be accepted in society and looked upon as something greater than myself. So the ballroom scene was something that was inside of me for a long time, and it developed at an early age. As it began to develop, I began to like myself, because as a child, I really didn't like myself. I was always told I could not accomplish anything, I was going to be a failure, that I would be gay. As I approached the ballroom scene, it made me feel like I was important. It gave me some insight to a whole brand new society that I was willing to just jump into. And I think this quote really encapsulates a lot of the feelings of the parents and members, is that this was a place, a supportive place to go, in spite of some of the risks, which leads me to this. So this is one slide just from, our survey of looking at some of the risk behaviors. So you see we have inconsistent condom use in the past 3 months at 27%, which is really not that different from other young YMSM studies. Sex exchange in the past 3 months, 12%. Now that is relatively high if we're looking at the past 3 months. We have a study with similar age YMSM that's about half of that for 6 months, so it's definitely higher. Drug use past 3 months, marijuana, very common in the ball scene. Ecstasy, also relatively common at 12%, and then general club drugs at 15% past 3 months. A little over a quarter have had an STI diagnosis in their lifetime. Really high HIV testing rates, because there's several different community organizations that do come in and do testing and offer free admittance to the ball if people get tested, so it's a really good incentive for this community. Self-reported HIV status is 6%. We did not do testing, so this is the HIV data that we have. Violence is very prevalent in this community. In fact, for the first couple years we worked in the community, I couldn't go to a ball without having to leave early because a fight broke out, and you never know what can happen. So physical fights in the last 3 months, almost a third have been in some kind of fight in the past 3 months, and they often compare themselves to gay gangs. So some of the struggles... our challenges is that trying to maintain that status. So they've got the status. They've been awarded, but now they have to maintain that status within the community. And that can lead to violence or throwing shade at each other. Members engage in illegal risky activities like sex exchange or escorting for money. There is also a credit card fraud in the Los Angeles scene where people were buying plane tickets for about $50 to New York or Paris through credit card fraud. It's been over the last 5 or 10 years that escorting has just exploded. These guys can make easy money. Most of these guys are pretty young. Somebody gives you $50 for this or $100 for that. It's easy. It's 5 or 10 clients within a day, and you can make a lot of money. But at what price and at what cost? So this is something the parents are very much concerned about. They felt that some of the pressure within the ballroom scene contributed to substance use as well, so taking stimulants to stay up until 8 in the morning. And some of the individuals who perform in the more acrobatic categories, where you have to kind of throw yourself on the floor, or the shablams, they felt that oftentimes people were taking drugs to numb the pain when they do throw themselves on the floor. So prior research with non-ball African-American young men that we've done, we show a lower drug use rate within Latino or Caucasian YMSM just in general. But this survey shows a higher use of ecstasy than other YMSM populations. And that's been kind of anecdotally confirmed through some of our community advisory board meetings with parents that say that cocaine and ecstasy are increasing over time as well. They also have higher rates of sex work, as I mentioned. And most parents have really strong opinions on what drug use can do to the ball scene. Like I said, dealing with it, drug use, in the past and watching that house makes it harder on me. So it really did tear up that house. Oh, yes, these people they're exceptional. And it's like a lot of people just deteriorated, like some of the best or the most gorgeous face kits. When you look now, you only see remainders of them. So it really has affected the scene. Another challenge is really just over-involvement in the scene. So you live in this unreal or fantasy world. They call it our little Hollywood. And they actually, create an alter ego with their ball name so that they have a different persona within the ball scene. But then when they have to leave that ball scene at 8 in the morning and go home to the realities of what the real world is, that can be a real challenge. So it's also seen as potentially more problematic for individuals who have dropped out of school or don't have a job. So many houses have rules that their kids have to have a job or be in school to be a member of that house. I still do live in this world, which is very hateful towards people like myself, and I have to know how to differentiate between reality and fantasy. People don't live in the ballroom scene. They get caught up in it into the hype. They also linked this issue of being too wrapped up in the scene to escorting, believing that those involved might be doing so because they didn't graduate from school or don't have a job, and that's their really only means of support. A lot of people sometimes get caught up in the fantasy and forget that there are other things besides the ball scene. That's why I try to remember to keep the kids in school or work. You got to do something outside the ball scene. Okay, and lastly, it's the perception and stigma of the ball scene. So you have all this validation and support within the community, but then you leave, and actually we did some interviews with individuals who are not a part of the house scene but may go to balls every now and then. The perceptions of the ball scene is that it's messy. They don't want anything to do with it. So it's actually this very small community that many people are just kind of hands-off with. So it actually creates more violence as well, potentially, within the community. And some parents felt that this actually had some bigger implications, that historically service providers might have stayed away because of the being a messy, unmanageable group. The house and ball community is a community of people who are riffraff in their minds, who engage in malfeasant behaviors. All they do is craft or booze or steal. So that's from one of the parents. So what does this mean? The title is laying the groundwork for intervention. So kind of this is our first stab at kind of really getting to understand this community. And we're still in the process of analyzing data that we've collected over the past couple years so that we can, as I said, develop an intervention that's really tailored to this community. But I think it is really necessary to do this kind of ethnographic, very intense study to design interventions for this type of community, because it's not really one size fits all. There are some special needs and some very supportive mechanisms within this community that I think are really ripe for building interventions on, such as the support and the validation. And I think this community-engaged approach is just key. As Scott said, I mean, you can't get the type of information that you would get otherwise. So having the parents involved in this process has been ultimately led to our success. So one of our next steps is to identify others working with the house and ball communities and identify interventions that may be acceptable. So there are pockets of work across the country that we are learning about over the last year or two. We have begun to reconvene our community advisory board, and we're getting a new group of house members to present our data results, intervention ideas, and discuss opportunities. And these can be really difficult conversations because it requires the parents to really think thoughtfully about what the risks are in their community and how they can really help the kids. And then in partnership with our community, we're going to design and adapt HIV prevention program building on those strengths. And I do want to acknowledge, we have a lot of people to acknowledge for this study, all the houses, and of course our funder, NIDA. So thank you.
Thanks. So before we open it up for some questions, I will make the announcement one more time, okay, so nobody can fault me. Business meeting 5:30 to 7, the social to follow from 7 to 10, and this is all at La Tosca down in Chinatown. So do we have questions for any of the presenters? Yes.
I never thought that would happen. But they actually did. Sparrow got there at 10:30 and they had already started. So that, it can work, I think. And I think it's really encouraging to see that that can work, because typically it's something that happens after the clubs close, if people are already drunk or they've been out all night. And so it just increases opportunities for risk. So I think that that is, I'm hoping that that can increase.
Questions? No? Okay, well, thank you, panelists.